This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we follow up on the pros and cons of a proposed smart city in Toronto. It's the brainchild of a Google subsidiary called Sidewalk Labs. Critics claim it's an experiment in the ultimate surveillance state. After Special Counsel Robert Mueller's statement in May about his investigation, calls to impeach President Donald Trump are once again creating divisions. We talk about these divisions and how this presents an opportunity for the left to mobilize. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last year, Law and Disorder featured a segment on Sidewalk Labs' proposed data-oriented smart city in Toronto. Sidewalk Labs is a firm owned by Google parent company Alphabet. At that time, we covered critics' concerns about residents' privacy and how their personal data would be stored and used. Last week, Sidewalk Labs released a 1,500-page development proposal for its planned smart neighborhood. They claim it will integrate physical, digital, and policy innovations to take on affordability, sustainability, and quality of life. Critics assert this is an experimental model for a surveillance state and covert data collection. Sidewalk Labs' plan represents a radical departure from the principles guiding city planning in Canada since citizen participation and accountability came to the fore in the era of renowned Canadian-American urban planner Jane Jacobs. Joining us to discuss Sidewalk Labs' proposal and its critics is Mariana Valverde, professor of socio-legal studies at the University of Toronto. She's an urban studies scholar whose research interests include public-private partnerships, governance, and infrastructure. Mariana, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Our listeners have heard a lot about so-called smart devices or internet-connected gadgets, but what is a smart city?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a term that is used very loosely and usually for kind of PR purposes. Now, there is no such thing as a smart city as opposed to dumb cities or, you know, whatever. What is usually done is that people will talk about a smart city project. So if some city government decides they want to have better traffic management systems that rely on sensors and live data and so forth, and they can say that's a smart city project. So there's a lot of smart city projects. If you look at the U.S. website Smart Cities Connect, which is, you know, an association of a lot of mainly smaller cities that are doing smart city projects, they share a lot of information about what kinds of things they do, and usually what happens is that the city itself will commission something or will say, we would really like some tech company to come up with a solution for things like how to detect a leak in a water pipe before you get a flood, things like that. So in that sense, that is a sensible use of the word smart city project, but a smart city in general, you know, there is no such thing. What makes a city smart? Is it the technology, the people, or what? So,
Mariana, what is Waterfront Toronto, and who is Sidewalk Labs?
Waterfront Toronto is a very peculiar, unusual public agency, and it's very unusual in that it was formed by all three levels of government, city, the province, which is like a state in the U.S., and the federal government. And it was tri-government because it came out of a failed Olympic bid, and Olympic bids are always the three governments. But there are no other agencies that are tri-government in Canada, and I'm not aware of any in the U.S. either. So there's lots and lots of public agencies all over the U.S. and Canada, but almost all of them are either a municipal or city-level agency or a state-level one or a federal one. So to have all three levels of government involved in forming it and running it makes it very peculiar, and it's the reason why it has very few powers and very little autonomy. Like, for instance, if you compare it to the Port Authority of New York, the Port Authority of New York has a lot more autonomy, financial and legal.
As I understand it, Sidewalk Labs, which is actually owned by Google's parent company called Alphabet, has a proposal to have a data-oriented smart city in Toronto.
Right. And if Sidewalk Labs had gone to, or any other Google company, had gone to the city of Toronto with a very vague proposal that would give them all kinds of powers and revenue opportunities and so on, the city of Toronto would have shown them the door, as would any other city. But they went to Waterfront Toronto at a time when the agency was going through a kind of existential crisis because government money was drying up. And the board of Waterfront Toronto, I mean, it's hard to know. There is very little sort of transparency, but it seemed that they were quite concerned about the fact that government money was drying up, and they were set up to run only for 25 years, and the 25 years was soon approaching. So there seemed to be a kind of existential crisis within Waterfront Toronto that made them receptive to an extremely vague and incredibly ambitious, unprecedented proposal from Sidewalk Labs. So I think it's very important that people understand that it's not the City of Toronto that's in any kind of partnership with Google. It's a public agency with an appointed board that has very little accountability to the citizens.
Okay, so that brings us to the issue of what is envisioned. Are they proposing a connected entity where citizens or residents' information is going to be gathered? And does that relate to a universal connectivity port called Koala?
Yes. Well, the data collection and use of sensors that are supposed to be mounted on this thing that they call Koala for some reason, though, of course, there's no koalas anywhere near this part of the world. That is part of it, but in the proposal they have submitted, that's only one part of it. If they had just stuck to saying, if some developer builds these buildings, you know, builds up the neighborhood, we will then do all these fancy sort of data things, well, that would be one thing. But they actually have a much more ambitious plan for themselves, which is quite surprising for a tech-oriented company. For one thing, they propose to be the lead developer, so to actually own land and develop buildings. And one of the things that they talk about at some length is how all of the buildings in this new neighborhood will be made out of tall timber. They have this obsession with tall timber for some reason. And they propose that a special factory to make the tall timber will be built, which is quite peculiar because the Google companies are not known for either having physical factories or for being developers. And in fact, in the original agreement between Waterfront Toronto and Sidewalk Labs, it said quite explicitly, Sidewalk Labs will not be acquiring any interest in property. And so now all of a sudden they say they want to be the lead developer, maybe because they know there's money to be made in real estate in Toronto. So the whole business of collecting data and using data to improve urban life, as they always say, seems to now be just one part of a much bigger development and real estate kind of deal and proposal. So, I mean, there's a public meeting tonight of people who were opposed to this kind of thing, and they've already decided they're not even going to talk about the data and the sensors. They're going to talk about the real estate and the weird proposals for a new transit line that will go directly to the new Google headquarters, which they insist the city will have to build before they develop anything, you know, which is one of the things that's making people very upset, the fact that they seem to think that they can demand that governments build a transit line that'll cost over $1 billion that'll go straight to their office.
Right. It seems like a very private benefit for Google. I wanted to ask, speaking of resistance and input from individuals, are people concerned about the many ways that this project could collect and store and use their personal data? And there seems to be such a lack of transparency. People may not be aware of the many ways that can be accomplished.
Right. Yes, there's all kinds of people. I mean, you know, there's a very lively tech sector in Toronto, so it's not like this is a tech desert and, you know, we really need Google to come in. There's all kinds of people here who know a lot about tech and who are engineers or sort of data scientists or software people, whatever, and they've been very active in saying, wait a minute, what are you proposing, and don't you realize that there's such thing as privacy laws? Not to mention the fact that, like, the koala thing that you mentioned, this mount that's supposed to be able to have all kinds of sensors, they propose that be placed on street lights, like over public streets, and they don't seem to realize that it's actually quite illegal to do that. You know, a private company can't start, you know, putting up sensors and cameras in public spaces. But anyway, so the tech sector has been leading really the resistance. So people like Bianca Wiley and Sadia Mufazar and others are very active in this. And there's also a lawsuit against Waterfront Toronto by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. And the lawsuit basically says that Waterfront Toronto never had the jurisdiction, the power, to sign the kind of deal that they did sign. They're suing Waterfront Toronto.
Yes, and I wanted to ask you about a related question. I understand that scientists at the University of Toronto have accepted funding, I believe, from the Sidewalk Labs. Is that a conflict?
Well, it certainly is, but the sort of backstory to that is that the computer science, the computer science department at U of T has long had very close relationships with Google, way before the creation of Sidewalk Labs, so that the university is planning to open a new artificial intelligence center right in front of my office, actually, and the sort of leader for that will be a computer scientist whose name is Jeff Hinton, who's supposedly one of the three founders of artificial intelligence, and he worked for Google for 5 years, and now he's back in Toronto. And so all kinds of computer scientists in Toronto or at the university have had a long-standing relationship with Google and have sold a lot of their inventions to Google. So that's a thing of long-standing. And then there's also some connection between Sidewalk Labs and a place called the Mars Center, which is supposed to be this innovation hub that is partly owned by the university and partly by the province and I don't know who else, but at the Mars, there's been groups within that have had contracts with Sidewalk Labs, and I'm sure they hope to have more contracts. So, yes, there's a relationship there, but I'm sure the administrators at the university would say, well, we have relationships with many companies and partnerships with the private sector, so they wouldn't think there's anything wrong with that.
You know, I've got to say that this entire proposed project, to me, sounds as though the residents are part of a large experiment.
Exactly. I mean, right from the beginning, like the first public meeting that I attended, I said, well, clearly we the citizens, are meant to be the rats in Google's lab, but they're not even feeding us. If we were actual rats, they'd have to feed us. So I've been saying that right from the beginning, and now it's even more apparent.
What are the primary privacy concerns that have been raised?
Well, it's unclear sort of what exactly, what type of information would really be collected, because what Sidewalk Labs does is always give you little stories, like the one they constantly mention is, well, if we had a smart pedestrian traffic light that could detect that a little old lady's crossing the street and needs more time, well, then that would be so great, wouldn't it? Because then the light could slow down and you wouldn't get the red so quickly. And what I always say is, well, but what else would that sensor pick up other than the fact that there's somebody who's walking slowly? Maybe would have facial recognition technology, because this guy, Jeff Hinton, the computer scientist who's long had a close relationship with Google, he's one of the inventors of facial recognition technology, and I'm sure, you know, they'd be wanting to try this out. So what they do is that they don't really tell you what they plan to do, and what they have said right from the beginning is that we will not sell personal information to advertisers. And I believe that is true. That is not their business model. I think their business model here is much more the research and development lab, where they're developing algorithms and software and gadgets that can then be sold all over the world. What I've learned from the tech experts that I've talked to is that Google has made its first, whatever it is, hundreds of billions of dollars from selling advertising using your personal information. But now they're kind of in this new stage, and they're much more interested in intellectual property and new inventions and new apps and new ways of connecting data sets. That's what they're really interested in. So we're not really sure what they would plan to do. As I said, they give you all these little examples of how urban life could be improved with a smart sensor, but they don't tell you what else that sensor would do.
Do you think it's possible that this model can then be replicated really globally?
When I started looking at the plan that was released just a week or 10 days ago, and I also read a lot of the critical commentary that started up immediately, what I thought is that, well, they're being so arrogant and so insulting to their public partners that they must be getting ready to go somewhere else with this plan. Because if they really wanted to stay here, I think they would have gone more out of their way to be more conciliatory. And like, for instance, one of the things they say in their plan is that they propose that a whole new public authority will be developed to sort of supervise this new semi-privatized district. Well, there already is an authority, which is Waterfront Toronto. And so for Sidewalk Labs to basically say, oh, well, who needs you? There needs to be a new public authority that has different powers and is completely different. I mean, that kind of thing doesn't exactly endear you to, you know, the decision makers. And the chair of the board of Waterfront Toronto immediately, as soon as the plan was released, immediately released an open letter that was already quite critical of Sidewalk Labs.
You raised an interesting phrase, and that is semi-private and public spaces. And it made me wonder, if this development does go through, is this considered public property so that if people from other neighborhoods want to walk through, hang out, it's not a gated community, is it?
No, it's not meant to be a gated community, at least not with physical gates. I expect they imagine that it'll be kind of electronic gates, if you will, but not physical gates. And they do say, well, the streets would be public streets and owned by the City of Toronto, and the transit line would be owned by, you know, the Toronto Transit Commission, so they're not going to own the streets and the transit. On the other hand, they also have a plan to set up some new energy system, a district energy system, and they don't say anything about the fact that, you know, there's a bunch of utilities in the City of Toronto, there's Toronto Hydro, and that, you know, there's water and sewers and everything else that are throughout the city, and there's already an authority that is in charge of that. So, yeah, I mean, they do say, oh, the streets will be public, but it's not clear. They also talk a lot about open space and how they want to have all this open space, but they don't specify whether that open space is considered public or private.
What about police force? Will it have its own force?
No, I don't think so. They don't mention that at all. And I expect they don't really have any interest in, you know, spending money on private security guards. I mean,
right. That
doesn't happen in Toronto. I mean, there's one or two places in the city that have kind of their own little security, but it's very unusual, and we don't in Toronto have any gated communities that have their own security or anything. And I'm sure they wouldn't want to spend money on this. I mean, one of the things that is very striking about the plan is how cheesy they're being. So, for instance, with the transit line, they do say, well, we insist that this transit line be built before we do any development. And they do say, oh, well, it'll, you know, it's been estimated to cost $1.2 billion, and we will give $100 million towards it, which is, of course, you know, pocket change for Google. So for them to say, we'll give $100 million, well, you know, that's just...
not a very good deal. Right, it's
yeah.
An insult.
And they don't really want to spend any money. I mean, they make that so clear, and they talk about things like, well, we will be owed performance payments if we actually deliver sustainability and, you know, better energy, you know, savings and so on. And so the idea of a private company getting performance payments from the city or Waterfront Toronto just for doing what they said they were going to do, I mean, that's not getting a very good reception.
Do you think the change to an arrogant attitude is in response to public resistance?
Well, I think Dan Doktoroff was always extremely arrogant, but at the beginning, like, I went to two or three of the first public meetings, and he was nowhere to be seen. And they had this other guy, Rohit Agarwala, who continues to work for Sidewalk Labs, but I think he's just in New York anyway. So Agarwala was, you know, has a different kind of personality, and he was a little more agreeable, and he didn't show any knowledge of the local politics or anything. I mean, in their first public meeting about this plan, which was a long time ago, it was well before there were any details, but like, I've gone to many meetings about, you know, proposed developments, and the local city councilor is always there. Well, it struck me that there wasn't a single city councillor. And in fact, there was nobody from city staff, so nobody from the city planning department, nobody from city transportation. So they started out by totally marginalizing the city, and even when it is Waterfront Toronto that is taking the lead on some waterfront new park or condo or whatever, the city is always represented at the public meetings, and people can ask questions. And so the fact that it was Rit Agarwala and a couple of other people, and I talked to a few people, like in the hallway, some of the people who were there supposedly facilitating and explaining these drawings and these plans, and they were all from New York. So I said to this one guy, oh, so are you a planning student? Because he was supposed to be showing me some landscape architect kind of drawing. And he said, oh, no, actually, I'm a computer engineer. And I said, oh, what do you work on? He said, oh, the Internet of Things. And I said, oh, and you live here? Oh, no, I live in New York. So I thought, okay, that's really interesting. And a journalist that I talked to yesterday said that, at the press release for this plan, I guess a week ago Monday, it was all people from the U.S. It was somebody from New York, somebody from Chicago, somebody from Minneapolis, all these people who work for Sidewalk Labs. They were all speaking and presenting things. So that shows a certain institutional arrogance, but Dan Doctoroff is also very personally arrogant, which doesn't go over well here.
We are unfortunately coming to the end of our session. Is there anything we haven't covered, Mariana, that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
Well, I hope that your listeners, you know, keep tabs on this, because I think it will be significant for other people. And there is a Block Sidewalk website and hashtag Block Sidewalk as a Twitter feed. So if people are interested, they could look at that. They could also look at the website of Waterfront Toronto. So I hope people follow the story.
We will definitely put links to those on our website. And Mariana, we really appreciate your taking time to join us today. Thank you so much.
Okay, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller's May statement on his investigation and report revived calls to impeach President Donald Trump. Such calls rest on solid legal ground. There's already more than adequate evidence supporting at least 7 articles of impeachment, 4 more than President Richard M. Nixon would have faced had he not resigned in 1974. Despite that, there's been significant internal debates among the left about whether to impeach Trump. The internal debates aren't on the legal grounds. They pertain to strategy. And these debates are fracturing alliances among both liberals and the left. Joining us now to discuss this issue is attorney Abi Hassan. Abi is a criminal defense lawyer, technologist, and co-founder of the Black Movement Law Project. He was formerly the Mass Defense Coordinator at the National Lawyers Guild National Office and worked for years as a union and community organizer. Abi's podcast is called Against the Law. Abi Hassan, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Abi, you and Sam Lewis have written an article in Truthout titled The Left Should Direct the Impeachment Effort. In that piece, you talk about the so-called resistance. Who is that?
Well, as we say in the article, the resistance is the formation that arose largely as a response to the election of Donald Trump and consists mostly of women, maybe skews older, but the people who are the most activated at hating Trump, frankly.
So in a way, it's a reactionary movement.
Well, reactive, I'd say. It's not necessarily reactionary in any traditional political sense, but it is largely formed out of reaction.
Why are many in the Democratic Party leadership hitting the brakes on the issue of impeachment?
I don't know. I don't think, I think that there's been a huge push on Pelosi, and because, that's where impeachment has to start in the House of Representatives. So there's been a big push on Pelosi, and, she's given various rationales for why not to impeach, none of them particularly convincing in my opinion. So I don't really know why there's so much resistance to it. A good faith reading would be that they don't think it's strategically wise.
Even though it's legally grounded, they have plenty of reasons legally.
Well, it's not a legal process. It's a political process, right? Like the Constitution provides a mechanism for one branch of the government to hold the other branch accountable, and that is the impeachment process. There isn't, I think that the Mueller investigation has gotten people caught up in legalisms when that is kind of a distraction, right? Because fundamentally, you can't bring the president to court and deal with the presidency through a court. The Constitution provides a way to deal with the president, and that is the impeachment process.
In your article, you and Sam urge socialists and long-term progressive activists to see this as an opportunity. How would bringing impeachment be an opportunity?
Well, from my perspective, I think it's an opportunity. One, it's an opportunity to create new alignments between a left. And when I say left here, I'm not talking about kind of the Democratic Party center. I'm talking about like left in terms of like a socialist or very progressive left, right? So when it provides, I think, an opportunity because there is motivation in the anti-Trump resistance formations, strong motivation against Trump. So it provides an opportunity to show some leadership there, right? But I think also, and I think most importantly, Trump didn't come from nowhere, right? Trump came from real estate, specifically New York real estate. And, people are acting shocked and awed that there's Russian money sloshing around but I think that it can also be an opportunity to really expose one of the most corrupt sectors of our society. And, I think that there's a lot of political will in the country to, we talk about getting money out of politics. This is the money that's in politics that created Trump, right? And so I think that if it's framed around the issue of exposing Trump and his ilk's networks and the way these guys operate, the way they're taking, D.C. and New York are just filled with foreign money from not just Russia, from Saudi, from China, from everywhere. Everyone who wants to hide their money, is bringing it through LLCs and other type of corporate loopholes. So there's so many ways of attacking a completely corrupt, like, capitalist establishment by using impeachment, because all of that is implicated in the dirty deeds of Trump. All of those, you know, dark corners of capital, real estate, foreign money, foreign influence, all that kind of stuff.
And real estate does play a huge part in this in terms of international LLCs and entities buying up buildings.
Yeah, because, you know, I think for good or bad, the U.S. is a relatively stable country, right? If you have tons and tons of money that you need to put somewhere, you know, you can't just put it in a bank that'll get taxed. You can't just put it, you know, you can't necessarily invest it in development in your home country for, you know, maybe political reasons or whatever. And some, frankly, a lot of these people just have too much money, right? And so, you know, investing in New York real estate, you know, it can be, it's a piggy bank for them, right? Like they can just dump a bunch of money here and they know that it's going to be relatively safe. You know, a side note, like, you know, I'm part of DSA and we've taken on
DSA being
the Democratic Socialists of America just this past year have hit a real body blow to the real estate industry in terms of changing the rent laws and
yes.
stuff. So maybe it won't be as safe a place to keep your money. Let's hope. But for now, like, they're dumping their money here, building buildings that no one lives in. And this is a global phenomenon, frankly.
It's like old landlords in the 70s and 80s warehousing apartments and buildings in New York City, where they kept people from living there, but then turned them around for a huge profit.
You know, it's an age-old problem, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, who owns the land?
Let's go back to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for a second. She is forcefully making the case that Democrats should tamp down impeachment expectations and focus on the elections. What is wrong with that? To repeat a little of what you said.
You know, the line that I've heard is that because the Senate won't convict, right, that therefore, for some reason, that means it's not a good thing to go and investigate and expose. And that just doesn't make sense to me. I don't agree with that. You know,
right.
I mean, the point is not, I don't think that the Senate, especially with, you know, a couple years left in his term, I don't think that the Senate a Senate conviction or an expulsion or whatever is really the end goal here. The end goal is to get him out of office through an electoral process, right? Like, that is the clearest goal. But I just fail to see how exposing his corruption and exposing his networks and his class, right? Like, I don't see how that is an impediment to getting him unelected.
It reminds me of why radical so-called movement lawyers bring political cases. A large part of it is knowing you may not be victorious, but you are giving a public forum for a person who represents a cause or a community who suffered some kind of injustice to get it out in the public forum. It's a very important process.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And frankly, like, if you want to get a little, you know, if you want to read some bad faith into the establishment Democrat view, like, you know, they probably have some stuff to hide. They are, a lot of them, very rich and are taking a lot of money from other much more rich people, right? Like, so, I think that there is an establishment interest in not exposing the vast amounts of corrupting money influence in Washington, D.C. But, you know, I don't think necessarily that that's a linear calculation being made, but that is part of what's motivating a lot of this.
In the piece, you and Sam quote Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin, quote, "Politics begin where the masses are, not where there are thousands, but where there are millions. That's where serious politics begin." What do we as a nation need to understand about the current movement?
The movement in terms of the resistance?
Yes.
Well, I mean,
the new resistance.
You know, I think that quote, it's funny. Sam put those quotes in it. I think it was very funny to have a quote from Lenin and from Donald Rumsfeld in one article. But the idea behind that is that the left for a generation has been hiding in the shadows, right? And so there's a conflict in kind of left circles of how to engage with the mainstream, right? There's been an allergy to the mainstream, I think largely driven out of a sense of hopelessness and like clinging to ideological purity. You get all those kind of things, right? But now we're in a moment where it's clear that the current system is not functioning and is in a state of transition. And that's clear to mainstream liberals as much as it is to hardcore leftists, right? And so I think that what the reason, you know, we put that quote in the article is to say that, like, now is an opportunity for the left to take leadership, right? And taking leadership requires engaging with actual people where they actually are, right? And the people that are closest to us are the people that we're most likely to get. And so those are the people we should be reaching out to.
You cite the women's marches of 2017 and 18 as being the two largest protest mobilizations ever in U.S. history. What is the significance of that? Does it mean we can rally the left now?
I mean, I think it means kind of what I just said, right? Like that it's increasingly clear to more and more people that something needs to be done differently. And, you know, if the mainstream Democrats would have their way, that, you know, we could just get rid of Trump and everything would go back to normal. But I think this is an opportunity for the left to say, actually, that old normal is what created this current disaster, right? So it's an opportunity to lead.
And speaking of opportunity, you write that it's not shocking that the left has yet to take advantage of this opportunity. Does this have anything to do with geographic or demographic issues?
Well, I mean, you know, as in the article we kind of mentioned the idea that this the resurgent left is most active in major cities, right? And the resistance as such, or, you know, is maybe largely more centered around suburban or, middle of the country, less, not the coastal big cities. And so, again, another opportunity, like, we're not going, you know, the left has to be everywhere, right? This has to be for a movement to really be able to make real change. We can't just be isolated. And so it's an opportunity to expand that base.
So what is it that socialists and progressives need to do to appeal to organizers of this resistance?
Well, I mean, that's why, you know, we wrote the article to say one of the things we could do. There's lots of things in lots of places. There's lots of different things. You know, obviously, any kind of movement, social movement, political movement is multifaceted. But, you know, one thing we could do is make it very clear that we want to impeach Trump, and these are the reasons, and that we're serious about it, right? That we're not just – we're serious about engaging with power. We're serious about – defeating and getting rid of Trump, but our reasons are not just because he's gross, but because there's a structural problem that created someone like Trump and that we need to engage that as primarily.
You're reminding me as we think about this of the tremendous spontaneous mobilizations during the Occupy movement, and you were right in the middle of that, supporting demonstrators all around the country. What lessons, and do you think there's a connection between the new resistance, the Occupy movement? Are there lessons for the resistance to take from that? We had such a tremendous clampdown because they were talking about, you know, the flaws with the financial system so that the government, law enforcement was ready from day one to really shut down as best it could the Occupy movement. It was just too much of a visual message striking right at the heart of the issues that you're talking about exposing now. Can this be successful a second time around, or is it an entirely different campaign?
The parallel that I would see is if any of these, so all of these things are kind of nebulous concepts, right? But if you think about what's happening now, and there's a huge mobilizations happening against the detention centers, against the horrific
human rights abuses.
Yeah, things happening with refugees and immigrants. And so, You know, that, I think, if those mobilizations become anything more than just marches, where if they're actually confronting, you know, trying to shut down or, you know, occupy style actions, right, then we're going to see a repeat of, you know, I think, of similar dynamics, right? And that's where I think the experience of Occupy is going to help, because the people that came out of Occupy understand a lot of them and have helped build the capacity to deal with that kind of state violence and state reaction. And so people are going to be more prepared for that kind of reaction this time than they were before. But, I think that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And this is, you know, this is that happening again.
You know, one of the critiques of the left, the so-called left, is that members are so caught up in the perfection of how an ideology is worded that it has to be absolutely pure. And that has been criticized as overlooking, you know, the forest for the trees. It's something the Republicans don't do, and in part is why the Federalist Society, the wealthy conservatives have been able to form a long-term plan in a way for getting judges at all levels of the courts and really in the Supreme Court. Is that still a flaw of progressives?
I think that there's a lot of reasons why the left is not or hasn't been ascendant for the last, you know, 70 odd years. And I don't think it's, you know, I would think that that kind of what you're articulating, that idea of purity politics or obsession with doctrinal adherence, I would say that that is more of a symptom than a cause. If we want to talk about the real causes, it's, you know, the Red Scare, the gutting of the unions, you know, the thing, the mid-century peace that was achieved was largely achieved with the complicit understanding that the left would not exist, right? And so that's the legacy, you know, that that's why there's literally one socialist politician in the country of any prominence until like 2 years ago, right?
Right.
So what was the question?
The question was, purity still a significant issue on the left?
Okay. So, and so where this, you know, I think that these kind of so-called purity politics come in are, I see them as a sign of a worldview that doesn't actually contemplate wielding any actual power. You know, I see it as a sign of hopelessness. And so I think it's on the wane, right? Like, I think that kind of worldview is just, it's not compatible with growing. It's not compatible with leading. It's not compatible with engaging with, you know, with difference. So I think that it is, that it's being reevaluated all over the left.
Do you think the resistance will be playing a key role in the midterms in 2020 elections?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the entire Democratic field of presidential candidates have largely adopted Bernie Sanders policies, right? So the influence, if Bernie Sanders is the most prominent leftist figure, right? That's influence is already seen. But in terms of ground and operations, political electoral operations, you know, in New York, there's certainly things happening, right? I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was a breakthrough. But and most importantly, what she has proved, and now Tiffany Caban hopefully is getting in. But what these campaigns have proved is a different model for running elections, right? That you can run an election with on popular issues, right? On leftist popular issues without institutional funding, right? Without real estate money, without corporate donations. But what you need is you need to actually motivate people. You need to actually build an organization to do that. And, you know, that's That's happening. I mean, that's happening everywhere, or not everywhere, but in, you know, specifically in New York, it's happening in Chicago, other places. So once you build that capacity, it's not going away. It just grows, right? Especially with victory after victory. So I think that the influence is not going to be seen as much on the headlines. And I think that the mainstream kind of political press is not interested in what people are doing on the ground as much. Maybe that'll change, but they're mostly interested in horse races and talking heads and sound bites. And, you know, like I was watching the debate the other night, and, it, you know, the only thought I had is that, like, this isn't helping us, right? We know what happens when the person who's best at TV becomes president. Like, that's not where it's at. So, but it's much harder to see the ground game, but it's there, and, you know, it's going to have effects on election results more than TV, I think.
Right.
But that'll change when the first few primaries happen, I imagine.
What is wrong, Abhi, with Senator Elizabeth Warren's argument that we should, quote, set aside political considerations and impeach Trump for, quote, disloyal behavior?
I mean, you know, I think fundamentally that's just a right-wing frame, right? It's it's a right-wing patriotic frame of viewing Trump, and I'm much less interested in that. I don't think that the problem with Trump is his lack of patriotism, whatever that means. The problem with Trump is he's an oligarchic, megalomaniac, rich guy who's basically bought his way into the presidency through like TV star fame, right? And is being largely supported by the rump of the most vile sectors of the right wing. So the problem is structural, not individual.
We just have a few minutes remaining. We've spoken about the positive side of the resistance being motivated by a revulsion at Trump. What are the downsides, if any, of that?
Again, I think that goes back to your previous question, right? The downside of it just being focused on Trump is that it doesn't give us it individualizes what are fundamentally structural and political problems. And so obviously Trump, you know, it's hard, right? Because I think that if we think about Trump in comparison to Obama, Obama's one of the loveliest individuals probably to ever be president. Like, I have huge problems with a lot of his politics. But like, as a person, it's very hard to dislike Obama, right? And Trump as a person is vile. But his politics are what matter, because he's the president, right? I don't care about a gross guy on the corner. I care about a gross guy who's wielding the most powerful military in the history of the world, right? Who has huge power. So when we individualize the problem, we fail to see the structures and the actual political mechanisms that create these things. And so that's why we wrote this article, right? Because we want to take that individual hatred of Trump and say, look, there's a whole big problem here. Let's use your individual hatred of Trump to expose something else and lead and also get rid of Trump, right? Like, we want to get rid of him, but we also want to use that as an opportunity to expose the bigger problem.
Abhi, I hate to let you go, but our time is ending. You have a podcast called Against the Law. How can our listeners, A, learn more about you and your writings, and B, listen to Against the Law?
Well, my Against the Law is available at againstthelaw.info, and it's me and my good friend and your friend Grania O'Neill, though we both had kids, so it's very intermittent. But I have one in the works, so it'll be
the
coming
two
out
best
soon.
Parents in New York City.
And you know, I'm most of my stuff that I've written is at Truth Out, but if you can go to abhihassen.com and abhihassen.com, and my stuff is there.
We'll put a link to it on our website. Abhi, we look forward to more articles analyzing the current state of political affairs and want to have you on back again. This was a timely piece, and it's always a pleasure to have you in our studio.
Sure, anytime.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Pick up every stitch.